This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt should say host, but also realtors with Oakwin Realty in downtown Vancouver. Super excited today because we've got Sam Atkins on the show. He's a not only a friend of the show, but he is a lawyer that practices Aboriginal law in the city of Vancouver. And really, we brought him on today to talk about the Cowichan decision, which has been all over the media. This is the first time a Canadian court has declared Indigenous title over privately owned land. And of course, there's been a lot of people concerned about the implications of both around this ruling. And we unpack everything. We talk about everything today. And it's a jam-packed hour. So I can't wait.
Absolutely, Adam. I feel like this is a landmark case with huge implications. There's a lot of people commenting on it. A lot of people commenting that probably know as much about it as you or me, and a lot of alarmist kind of rhetoric out there. So it's great to have what I would call the adult in the room, Sam Atkins, come on the show and explain exactly what's going on, kind of put it in the historical context and a broader context that I think is really useful, not downplay the implications, but really kind of spell out exactly how Sam sees it playing out over the next years and decades, really.
Yeah. When you say Sam's the adult in the room, you're kind of implying we're the children, but I guess that's what you meant.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't mean that, actually. I meant three adults having a very serious conversation.
One a little brighter than the other two.
One a little brighter than the other two, but actually positioning this podcast as the adult in the room. Let's say that.
Gotcha.
Position this podcast as the adult in the room of this discussion.
Yeah. And Matt, before we cut to this conversation with Sam, of course, we've got the segment that remains nameless. This is our trivia question. And I just gave you a trivia question before we push play here. You were talking about Coach from Cheers. I can't remember the context for that.
What was the context of it?
You're watching Cheers again.
I am watching Cheers. But that was, maybe that was it. I can't recall. Anyway, Coach from Cheers died after what? The first second season?
But how old was he?
He was 61 years old. And watching it, even today, as a 46-year-old, I can say he appears to be about 80.
It's unbelievable. Carla. Oh, yeah. She's still alive and well, though.
She actually looks quite young. Yeah, but she actually, in the first episode, looked quite young.
Yeah. Not the actual trivia question. Do you have a real trivia question for today?
No, your trivia question to me was George Wendt's nephew. Who is George Wendt's nephew who played Norm and passed away recently?
Yeah, and that's Jason Sudeikis. A lot of people don't know that, George.
I had no idea. But here is the actual trivia question for that segment that remains nameless, Adam. The Blue Jays just secured a 3-2 lead against the LA Dodgers. Everybody in Canada is enraptured by the series. We all know that the Vancouver Canadiens are the farm team for the Blue Jays, Adam, but we all don't know this, and I'll see if you do. How many players on today's Blue Jays roster previously have played for the Vancouver Canadiens? How many of today's Blue Jays made a stop in Vancouver before they made the show?
So Yusavich, I know, is one.
Yes.
Okay, Matt. So before I call a friend here, Yusavich is one.
Right.
We're all Blue Jays fans now. Yeah, I'm a huge fan as of game one. Exactly. So let me just think here. As I think, though, Matt.
But as you think, Adam, why don't we highlight? Should we highlight a new listing, or should we highlight one of our solds? Because we're selling properties right now.
You know what? We've actually, yeah, a lot of our listings have sold recently. We just had a great property that we've talked about once or twice on the show sell, which I think is such a good buy for the buyer and a good deal for the seller. Kind of one of those like win-win across the board for everybody. This was a brand new townhouse, the last of the townhomes at Cressy's development format, which is basically at Kingsway and Fleming or Dumfries. It's that block though.
Cedar Cottage right in the heart of it there.
Trendy Cedar Cottage. I love format. I love the finishes at format. I love the design. I love the amenities. And Cressy is the type of developer that you have people following them wanting to buy in their developments if they've lived in one before. We actually had a lot of people through the open that were like, oh, I haven't been to this project, but I currently live in a Cressy building and I love it so much. I just want to stay put. So anyways, a great sale. And it was a 2-bed, 2.5, 2-level concrete townhouse. Again, at format, nearly 1,200 square feet spread out over 2 levels with parking and storage and air conditioning. Just a spectacular property. So congratulations to the buyer of that one. And we're glad to have sold the last brand new townhome for Cressy. So that's great.
Absolutely. And I think it's still, as all of our featured listings are, over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over there to check out all of our featured listings currently, our recent solds. And Adam, click sell with us, because when you're there, you can click sell with us to download the sold plan that start on launch date, our PDF, our easily digestible PDF to get your property ready for market very quickly, to get it sold quickly and for top dollar. That's sell with us at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Now let's get back to this question, Adam. And I didn't expect you to know the answer. I know you've had time to think about it. You don't have phone a friend available. Should I give you, this is not very helpful. Is it 1 to 2 players, 3 to 4 players, 5 to 6 players, or 7 or more players? Ooh. Basically the whole roster.
Well, you know what's funny is I think I'm going to be wildly off here. I'm going to go with 3. So your second option, but I have a feeling it's going to be D, which was your last option. So
7 or more.
7 or more. And I have no idea, but I was surprised at the trajectory of that Yasavage guy, but I guess I'm not alone. What an amazing short launch that guy had to stardom here. So, but yeah, what's the answer?
Well, you know, I'm always rooting for you. I'm always rooting for you, Adam. The answer is C, 5 to 6, but I'll give you partial credit because 8 former Canadians contributed to Toronto's regular season success, but only 5 of them, and this includes one of the coaches, so 4 players and a coach, are taking on the LA Dodgers. So it's 5 is the answer, 5 to 6, option C.
Wow. You know, I've been, I think like a lot of Canadians that probably have never watched baseball before, I'm really enjoying this, this newfound interest this week in baseball and a new reason to sit in front of the TV. But you know what? The one thing, that game that went into the extra innings.
Oh, yeah.
That was brutal. Hey, is that a common thing?
Probably can't like be brutal common. As in...
As in, like, yeah, I went to bed at 11 o'clock at night. I had, yeah, by the end 11. There, I was.
I think the home run was near, it was what, at 11:47?
I turned it off, like, this. Honestly, the inning before. I was like, I can't do this.
Oh, really?
Anymore.
Okay. I fell asleep on the couch, woke up, Classic. Was about to shut it off, and thought to myself, I got 13 minutes till midnight. Maybe I stay up for that. And right then, the guy hit the home run. So that's why I know the time. But I missed about 3 of those innings because I was out cold.
Nice. All right. Well, Matt, without further ado, this is a great conversation. I would say a perfect overview of what's happening right now with the Cowichan decision. And again, very grateful to have Sam Atkins on the show. Who better than Sam to speak to this? So enjoy. This podcast is sponsored by Atlin at Clayton Crest, a master plan community in the West Clayton area built by Zentera Developments.
Zentera is an absolute force, Adam. They've been nominated for Multifamily Builder of the Year for 10 consecutive years and just won again at the Georgies for 2025 Multifamily Home Builder of the Year.
What's really exciting about Atlin is the West Clayton location. You're within walking distance to the future SkyTrain station, giving you that perfect balance of city access while living in a peaceful, family-friendly community in the Fraser Valley.
And if you have kids or are planning to start a family, there's an on-site daycare where residents get first access. This kind of thoughtful planning is why Zentera's projects stand out in the market.
The amenities at Atlin are incredible too, Matt. A rooftop patio with stunning views, fitness center, co-working space, and lounge areas for events. The outdoor space is extensive with two fitness areas, three children's play areas, and multiple spots to relax.
With major investments happening in the SkyTrain and the 72nd Avenue extension, West Clayton is set for explosive growth. This is genuinely one of those opportunities to invest in a community before values skyrocket.
And that's really the key here. This isn't just about finding a beautiful place to live. It's about making a smart investment in your future as the whole area continues to develop.
Pre-sales for Atlin will begin soon. Register today at atlincondos.ca. That's atlincondos.ca.
Okay, so we're here with Sam Atkins. He's a lawyer practicing in Vancouver, focusing on Aboriginal law. How you doing, Sam? Thanks for taking the time today.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks, Adam and Matt, for having me.
Maybe to start, Sam, can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So Sam Atkins, I'm a lawyer. I practice in Vancouver. I primarily focus on natural resources development. So I spend a lot of time working on, mining projects, energy projects, pipelines, forestry, that type of work. And as part of that work, I spend a lot of time dealing with Aboriginal law issues. And so I've followed, the case law pretty closely for my whole career, have been pretty focused on the Couchin decision and followed its sort of progression through the court and, provide advice to clients on Section 35 and Aboriginal rights and title and the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as it relates primarily to resource development in the province.
So maybe we should take a step back. I feel like a lot of our listeners are going to know a little bit about the Cowichan decision, have seen certain posts about it. It's all over the Vancouver Sun in the last couple of days. But for listeners who may not be up to speed on this decision, can you just give us a broad explanation of what it is, what it's all about?
Sure. So I'll say at the outset, I'm sort of speaking today in kind of my personal capacity with my personal views on the decision. Obviously, it's a significant decision. Lots of different opinions sort of flying around on it. I'm not speaking on behalf of any client. I'm not speaking on behalf of my firm or anything like that. But I can give you just a little bit of sort of context for the decision. So this is an Aboriginal title decision. And so Aboriginal title is a specific type of Aboriginal right. And Aboriginal rights in Canada are constitutionally protected. So we have what's known as Section 35 of our Constitution, Act of 1982. It is a section of the Constitution. Sometimes people think it's part of the Charter. It's actually separate from the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And it's a provision that basically just says the existing Aboriginal and treaty rights of the Aboriginal peoples of Canada, First Nations people, Métis, and Inuit people, are recognized and affirmed under the Constitution. And so for non-lawyers, what that means is that from 1982 onward, we've had constitutionally protected Indigenous rights in Canada. So that means that it's the highest law in the land. The province, the federal government, they can't act contrary to the Constitution. The net effect of that is we've had many, many years of courts trying to figure out, well, what does Section 35 mean? It doesn't define the rights. It doesn't tell you what they are. And so courts have kind of had to grapple with that. And so some of the early litigation in the 80s and 90s was around, well, what is an Aboriginal right? And so the courts would develop tests to say, an Aboriginal right to fish or an Aboriginal right to hunt. And if you can prove these things as part of this test, then the court will declare that there's an Aboriginal right there. Aboriginal title followed a slightly different path. Aboriginal title is sort of the highest form of an Aboriginal right. It's a right to the land itself. So it has a different test there were some big Supreme Court of Canada decisions, the Delgamuukw decision in 1997, the Chilcotin decision in 2014. And the court established a test, you know, has a number of different parts to it. But for these purposes, it's really just a question of, were the lands sort of, you know, sufficiently occupied by an Indigenous group at the time of the assertion of Crown sovereignty, which in BC, the date is set as 1846, such that they can say that we had those lands and that we have this Aboriginal title and interest. And then there's a bunch of consequences that flow from that. And so that's sort of the context we're in which the Cowichan decision has come down. Now, the interesting thing is we've never had a decision dealing with private property interests. And so Cowichan's a little bit different from that perspective. But we've certainly had many, many years of Aboriginal title decisions and understanding what it means. And so you can sort of view this case as almost sort of an evolution of that case law development.
And can we break down exactly what the Cowichan decision says? Like what was the decision?
So the Cowichan decision, so it's the Cowichan tribes, which is made up of a number of groups that are largely sort of based on Vancouver Island and the Gulf Islands, but they traveled. So they had winter camps in various places and summer camps. And so this was a summer camp, a summer village that the Cowichan tribes maintained on the Fraser River, in the current city of Richmond. And there's a sort of a historical context around the sort of occupation of that site at the time of the assertion of Crown sovereignty in 1846. But there's also some other elements to that site that are kind of specific to the Cowichan, to some of the promises, or at least what the court viewed as promises made by the Crown at the time the BC entered Confederation. But in any event, that site, of course, is now entirely private lands, some of which were held by the federal government, Canada, and held through the Vancouver Fraser Port Authority, and some held by the city of Richmond, and many lands held by just private landowners in the city. And so what is kind of, again, distinct about this decision is you're taking, you know, the case law that dealt primarily with provincial Crown land and declarations of Aboriginal title on those lands. And now you're saying, well, how do we reconcile an Aboriginal title claim in the context of private land? And so the court is grappling with this big issue and ultimately makes a number of declarations. And so there's six of them. The court finds that there is Aboriginal title over this claim area. Now, it's not the whole area that the Cowichan were claiming. It's a smaller subset of that area. But the court finds that there's Aboriginal title of the Cowichan to this claimed area, which includes, as I mentioned, some lands held by Canada, some lands held by Richmond, City of Richmond, and a number of, a large number of properties are held by private landowners. The second piece, and this sort of quickly gets into sort of the legal aspects of the decision, but the Crown said that those private property interests, the Crown grants that were initially provided by government, unjustifiably infringe Cowichan's Aboriginal title rights. So that's sort of a second piece of it, saying that there's Aboriginal title and that these fee simple interests infringe that right and that infringement is not justified. And we'll talk a bit more about that. And then this is the piece that's been picked up in the media, is the court then made a declaration saying that Canada and Richmond's titles, but just Canada and Richmond's titles, are defective and invalid. So basically saying those titles, because of this Aboriginal title claim, and because there weren't, and I'll talk a bit about some of the defenses, because there weren't defenses to that, or at least the defenses, the court, they weren't successful on those defenses, that those titles are defective and invalid. And then there are obligations on the Crown, the federal Crown Canada and the provincial Crown BC, to negotiate with the Cowichan in relation to those specific lands. So with Canada related to, so there's sort of a subset of the decision related to a fuel delivery service for YVR Airport, where the court didn't find the title was valid, defective and invalid, but imposes a requirement on Canada to negotiate. And then with BC, basically the court, and we'll talk a bit more about this, the court really focuses on the role of the BC government as the provincial Crown. And there's an obligation on the BC government to negotiate in good faith to try and resolve this apparent conflict that now exists between those fee simple private lands and the fact that there's a declaration of aboriginal title. So that's sort of the key aspects of the decision, I think, as it relates to the private lands piece.
So just to fully understand, Sam, so the stakeholders involved, it's Canada, BC, the Cowichan Band, and the private landowners that own the property in fee simple, and the city of Richmond. Yeah.
So there's the actual sort of parties to the litigation were the Cowichan tribes. So they're the ones who brought the claim. There's Canada, there's the city of Richmond, and there's the province of British Columbia. Those are the defendants. And then two other First Nations, the Musqueam and the Tsawwassen, have also intervened in the decision because they obviously have interests in the area as well. So those are sort of the key parties to the litigation itself. Private landowners were not a party to the litigation. Right. So they weren't part of the litigation. And I think what we've heard over the last couple of days is this concern about, well, why weren't they notified? And in fact, there was a decision by the court because there was an application brought by the defendants saying that those landowners should be notified and should be brought into the litigation in some fashion. And the court said, no, you know, this is already complicated enough, this litigation. We don't want to bring in, you know, hundreds or whatever of potential other defendants into this litigation. Cowichan is not seeking any kind of remedy against those properties. And so the court sort of found it would be more prejudicial to provide that notice than to not provide it. And so that was a decision a number of years ago. Obviously, that's been a focal point in some of the public consultations is why didn't private landers get told about it? And so that's been one of those things that's been circulating.
When you say not seeking remedy in this case, what does that mean? Because so John Smith owns a house since 1973, wakes up one morning to this court case in the news, finds out it's part of his land. What does this actually mean for that homeowner or owner of fee simple land in that area?
Yeah. So there's a few pieces to it. So one, if I sort of back up and talk a bit about Section 35 more broadly. So Section 35, the courts have over and over again in Canada said that one of the driving purposes of Section 35 is reconciliation. And what reconciliation means from the court's perspective, it's the reconciliation of the assertion of Crown sovereignty over the lands that are Canada and the pre-existence of Indigenous societies. And then the reconciliation by the Crown of those interests with non-Indigenous Canadians, right? So there's this sort of balancing that kind of happens. And all of that responsibility is really on the Crown, either the federal government or the provincial government, depending on the issue. So when you read the decision, the decision is dealing with a series of declarations. And so a declaration is not like a judgment in the sense of you've gone to court, I've now got a judgment, and I'm going to go enforce that judgment against you. A declaration is a little bit different. A declaration is actually a statement by the court that something is the case. And the intention of that statement is to provide guidance to the parties to resolve those issues. And so a lot of Aboriginal law cases have kind of proceeded on the basis of declarations that then provide guidance to the parties to go and sort that out. And so when you read the decision, ultimately what the court does, it's very careful around, you know, the way in which the declarations are structured to say there's an Aboriginal title interest. It nowhere does the court say that does that invalidate the fee simple interest of any third parties other than Richmond and Canada, right? So the court does not say that. In fact, the court doesn't resolve at all, which is kind of one of the challenges. But the court doesn't invalidate that title. The court just doesn't deal with that issue at all, right? There's Aboriginal title, there's fee simple. We're not going to deal with the outcome of that. What the court does instead is they focus their attention on the BC government. They say, well, the provincial crown under Section 35, it's your sort of constitutional obligation to try and deal with these issues. And so what the court really is doing is saying, BC, you need to go and sort this out and negotiate an outcome to try and reconcile these apparently, you know, these clearly, you know, conflicting interests. So you wake up one day to the Cowichan decision. There are some consequences, and we'll talk a bit about that. But you still own your land, right? You still have a fee simple interest to your land. No one's coming to take your land. Cowichan have been very clear, both within the litigation itself, but also just in the last number of days, like they are not seeking a remedy against third party you know, landowners in Richmond. That's not to say there aren't consequences, and that's not to say this isn't a significant decision, but to your example, I can't remember, you say John Smith wakes up one morning, he still owns his property, right? And still ostensibly has all the same rights that he had the day before.
The one thing, Sam, and I mean, we're maybe kind of getting into it, the implications maybe prematurely here, but so John Smith now has a property that would be very challenging to sell in light of the news. So there's that. And then John Smith also, according to the meeting last night, I think there was one gentleman who was talking about challenges with financing.
He owned his property since 1975 or something like that.
Yeah, and legitimately was suggesting that that refinancing, that getting a mortgage might be challenging because obviously lenders are going to see a lot of risk now. Like, do you see other fallout for the private landowners in the area? And do you think there'll be recourse for these folks?
It's a great question. And I think that's the great unknown at the moment. And I'll say this, you'll periodically get these major decisions coming out from an Aboriginal law perspective. I mentioned Delgamuukw and Chilkoot, and you get these significant decisions, and there's a period of time where it's people are digesting them, they're figuring out what they mean, how do we respond to them, and how do we kind of move forward. So there's a bit of a digestion period. The decisions are also being appealed, of course, the BC Court of Appeal, and presumably everyone expects ultimately to the Supreme Court of Canada. So this will not be the last word on the decision. We'll see where the courts ultimately go. And we can talk a little bit more about some of the different arguments that people are making around the decision. But I not for one second would I say that there aren't real implications, right, for John Smith or whoever. Hopefully there's not actually a John Smith in the title area. But that's the issue, right? Is how are lenders going to respond to this, right? And, you know, will there be challenges in renewing mortgages? Like, in theory, on the law, there's been no change in the fee simple. The private land still exists, but it does have the specter of there's an Aboriginal title declaration of the lands. And the challenge is nobody knows what that means, right? Because we don't have the guidance from the court. The court didn't deal with the issue. And so we don't have a resolution to that issue from a legal perspective. From a practical perspective, you know, the court is saying, BC, go sort these things out. And so there'll be, I think, practically speaking, the focus on government to try and resolve some of the issues. But that's not to say that, you know, lenders may be nervous, right? People may not want to invest in lands, you know, new capital projects or do different things on those lands in the near term because of this uncertainty. I don't know how, for example, the BC Assessment Authority would sort of look at when you value those properties. Do you look at it differently? So there are a lot of questions I think that people have, and they're fair questions and they're serious questions. And I think it'll take some time to sort of, you know, how all of that works out.
I'm just thinking, Sam, like, do you see this as kind of the tip of the iceberg of what could be future claims against privately owned land? And I'm thinking like where Aboriginal title can be proven through historical occupation and exclusive use, Crown grants could be perceived as invalid. So like where else in BC do you think might be at risk? Or is this generally anywhere without treaties?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the challenges, so with the Cowichan decision, I mean, there are some unique aspects to Cowichan in the sense of like, this was a very specific site. There's a lot of historical record around it. There is, as I mentioned, you know, some of the aspects around BC's entry into Confederation around the setting aside of Indian settlement lands as part of that. There are some very specific things about Cowichan that wouldn't necessarily apply in every case. That said, there are Aboriginal title claims across all of British Columbia, and there are Aboriginal title claims in many parts of Canada, right? BC has typically been the place that a lot of the case law and a lot of these issues have arisen from. And it's in large part because BC didn't historically pursue a treaty-making process in the province, as was the case in not all parts of Canada, but many parts of Canada. And so, you know, outside of some treaties on the southern part of Vancouver Island, known as the Douglas Treaties, and a piece of Northeast BC that's covered by one of the number of treaties, Treaty 8, BC doesn't have treaties. And so a lot of these issues, these sort of outstanding land claims, have really centered in BC. So all of the big Aboriginal law decisions have tipped BC, and they've typically come out of these concerns that these issues have not been addressed. So the challenge, I would say, with the decision is, although from the perspective of trying to direct these issues back at the Crown, the decision is sort of cautious in trying to sort of do that. The challenge is the decision says a whole bunch of things about fee simple title that would be a problem everywhere, right? So it'd be a problem anywhere in British Columbia, presumably anywhere in the lower mainland. We're on, you know, go to a hockey game, like we're all on unceded and unsurrendered land. And there are Aboriginal title claims blanketing the city. Now, I think when you read the Cowichan decision, I sort of spoke a little bit about this. Like, I think one of the challenges with the decision is that you could certainly read the reasoning for why Canada and Richmond's titles were found to be defective and invalid could certainly apply to all of those other third-party lands. The issue is that they would have defenses, right? And there are some defenses in the case that would almost certainly apply to third-party landowners in Richmond. So, for example, a bona fide purchaser for value without notice. It's a principle that we have in our law. It's an equitable defense that we have where you'd say, look, I bought this land. I've kind of relied on the fact that I bought this land. I paid money for it. I was not aware of an Aboriginal title claim. And a court could say, well, look, in this case, there's no remedy against that private landowner because they have a defense to it. So there's a variety of things where you'd say there's some defenses. But I think the broader issue is going to be, is that really what we want to rely on, right? Like, is that, like, so I think the appeals courts are going to be concerned about this. I think the Supreme Court of Canada is going to be concerned about this. Our system is so heavily reliant on concepts of private ownership. You know, our system of commerce is based on it, like lending is based on it. You guys have sort of talked about that. Like, this is such an important aspect of our society that I think courts are going to be very concerned about, well, what are the implications of this, right, to our economy, to commerce, to people's, you know, these are very, very real issues. Now, that'll all get counterweighed against what is also a very important issue, which is the Indigenous interests in those lands and broader reconciliation issues. But I do think we'll see courts, as this moves its way through the appellate courts, that will look for ways to protect that interest, or at least provide a little bit more guidance on how to protect that interest. Because it's obviously something I don't think we want to have third parties that are wholly unrelated to government having to address these types of issues.
Yeah, is this overstepping, Sam, to think that this kind of fundamentally challenges the Crown's ability to have sold off land in the first place? Like, I'm just thinking from a land titles, you know, where your name goes on title, you pay for a piece of property. Since the founding of British Columbia, that it's all invalid, that they didn't have the right. Like in some ways, this seems to be right into the heart of the entire system of private property ownership in British Columbia. Is that overstating it? Maybe.
Well, I mean, it's the challenge with this decision is that's right in many respects. Like, in some ways, we haven't dealt with these issues in the province, right? And so is it a problem everywhere? Probably not, right? In the sense of, yes, there are Aboriginal title claims across the province, but because of the actual tests that you have to show, it's not just, you know, you have to show this occupation, and it has to be sufficient occupation of a particular piece of land at a certain time. So I think as you kind of work through some of those issues, it's not necessarily the case that, you know, every piece of land in BC is subject to a significantly credible and high likelihood of having Aboriginal title, but it's still an issue. There are, like, so I mentioned one of the declarations was that the fee simple titles unjustifiably infringed. Now, there is this concept that you can have Aboriginal title and you can have an infringement of the Aboriginal title. The Crown uses the land, gives the land away, does different things. It is possible that the Crown is entitled to infringe on that Aboriginal title where it can justify it. And there's case law in the Delgamuukw, like the Delgamuukw decision, the Chilcotin decision, both talked about some of the broader purposes, public purposes, that the Crown could rely on to say that something is a justifiable infringement of that Aboriginal title. And so they talk about the wording of the cases as having a compelling and substantial objective to be able to deal with that. And this is where I get back into the sort of balancing that Section 35 takes. But part of that is, you know, the court uses a bunch of examples that may be things that can have a compelling and substantial objective. And one of them is settlement, right? So I'd like to sort of say there's a lot in the law, there's an awful lot in this case, where I think there will be more to be said as this case proceeds to appeal and then ultimately to the Supreme Court of Canada. And again, I sort of say, you know, I mentioned sort of it takes a while to digest and distill these things. One of the good things about our system, I mean, it's very difficult. This is a very long case. Like, it was over 500 days. Aboriginal title cases are some of the longest cases in Canadian history because there's so much evidentiary burden to bring forward to be able to prove these things from you know, periods of time that 150 years ago or more. And so one of the things that is good about our system is, you know, the trial judge is trying to wrap their arms around all of this evidence and provide a judgment based on all the arguments. Now people are going to come away and say, well, we got this judgment. They're going to come away and say, well, what are the arguments we should be making? So they'll distill their arguments. And so the appeal court's going to have the benefit of sharpened arguments, that initial judgment. There'll be areas where the appeal court may disagree or agree on how those things were framed. And so we'll see, I guess, is where I'd say we go. But I do think the courts are going to be concerned about what is the implication of this more broadly than just on this little strip of the city of Richmond. They're going to be thinking about this much more broadly than that.
Can we clarify the stance of the province?
In terms of what they've argued, is that So yeah, the province. I mean, the province. So one of the issues is, so I talked a bit about Section 35 in 1982. So 1982, we constitutionally protected rights. In theory, prior to 1982, those rights could have been extinguished, and they could have been extinguished really through federal legislation. And I say this sort of as maybe more in legal terms as opposed to practical terms. But prior to 1982, it was possible that those rights could have been extinguished and therefore they're not constitutionally protected. They don't exist after 1982. So one of the issues, though, is, of course, more broadly, BC is very much focused on Indigenous reconciliation. They've adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as has the federal government. And one of the things that has happened federally and provincially, actually, is there's been a series of litigation directives that have been provided from the province to people that are arguing these cases and saying, these are the types of things we're not going to argue anymore. We're not going to take these positions. And one of those was actually on unilateral extinguishment of rights. And so the province did not argue that the grant of the fee simple itself unilaterally extinguished Aboriginal title. And that they've been criticized for that. The city of Richmond argued it. But the province has a different, although similar, legal theory. And their legal theory is that basically the grant of the fee simple displaced the Aboriginal right for so long as the fee simple was there. And so, you know, they have different ways of kind of getting at the same argument, but the province, it's true, they didn't argue extinguishment, which they would have otherwise been entitled to do. So, you know, that's sort of one, again, another piece of the puzzle here. And I think the province has been obviously a little bit on the hot seat on that issue the last couple of days in particular.
So one of the key things we've been talking about, Sam, is unceded lands and the lack of a treaty in place. If you think like across Canada, like for example, I think a Treaty 1 in Manitoba, does the existence of a treaty change the outcome in your mind for a claim like this one? Or is this something that may be challenged down the road as well?
So yeah, it's an interesting question. So BC certainly, because of our history, has been a focal point for a lot of Aboriginal rights litigation around unextinguished land claims and things like that. It is true that particularly over, for example, the Prairie provinces, there were the treaties 1 through 11 that were negotiated. And so if you were to look at a map, you would see it's covered by treaties 1 through 11 across all of the Prairie provinces. I mentioned to a little corner of Northeast BC, bits of Ontario, etc. And those treaties, when you read them, say that the First Nation treaty signatory is, you know, hereby ceding and surrendering their interest in the land in exchange for the promises in the treaty. So on its face, one would think Aboriginal title claims face an uphill battle. In practical terms, though, I think, you know, the law is still evolving. So one obvious point is, for example, the Métis across the Prairies. The Métis are not captured by historic treaty. They were focused on First Nations people. The Métis have Aboriginal title claims across the Prairies, for example, and that they're advancing. There are differing interpretations of what the historic treaties mean. Obviously, they're written in English. They were, you know, written agreements with groups that historically had oral traditions. And so there's broader views of, well, what do the treaties actually mean? And so there are questions around that. And then even just practically speaking, you know, sometimes groups or pieces of land or things like that were missed, right? And so there's, for example, Aboriginal title claims in Ontario that involved him where there were questions about, you know, this isn't actually covered by a historic treaty. And then I guess the last point I make, you know, so the number of treaties are one thing, but on the East Coast, for example, there are what are known as the peace and friendship treaties that don't speak at all to what the implication is for title and things like that. So these issues are not limited to BC by any stretch of the imagination.
Sam, you know, you mentioned the UN Charter. BC seems to be one of the more complicated places in Canada, although clearly what you just outlined there sounds like this will be an alive kind of process that maybe exists ongoing forever. Who knows? Are there places around the world that have dealt with this? Are there models? Or is British Columbia kind of at the forefront of this process of sorting these issues out?
For all of Canada's faults, and there are a lot of faults, you know, one thing you could say about Canada from a legal protection perspective, like we're one of the few countries in the world that has constitutionally protected Indigenous rights. And a result of that is we've got sort of 40 or 50 years of case law in this country trying to figure out what does that mean, right? Like, how do we balance these interests? How do we deal with reconciling interests and rights? And so we've actually got a pretty well-developed sense of the law. And, you know, as BC and Canada have endorsed the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, I think a lot of that case law will inform, well, how do we approach UNDRIP, right? Like, how do we, you know, we can't sort of ignore the fact that we're all here, right? We're sitting in downtown Vancouver and there's a lot of people here. Nobody's leaving. And so a lot of our law is really focused on, like, how do you kind of balance these things out? And, you know, one of the things that I think Canada has done well, at least certain parts of the country, is we've got, you know, we put in place like a comprehensive land claims policy, right? And it actually came out largely as a result of, there's a decision called Calder in 1973 that involved the Nisga Nation and their claim that they had never surrendered their interest in lands. One of the outcomes of that decision was really the comprehensive land claims policy federally. And so we've seen, for example, modern treaties that have been negotiated in the territories. In BC, we've got a number of groups that have negotiated treaties, including the Nisga Nation, who I just mentioned brought the Calder case. One of the groups that intervened in the Cowichan decision, the Tsawwassen, they have a modern treaty, and they've resolved all these issues, right? So there are, and I'm not suggesting treaty is the answer all the time. BC is doing all kinds of sort of incremental approaches to treaty. One of the companion cases, for lack of a better word, the Cowichan decision, at least as it relates to third-party interests, was the Haida head litigation that, at the same time as that, I mentioned that sort of decision not to notify third parties, that decision was made in Cowichan. It was also made in the Haida litigation to do the same thing, and the court said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, BC has resolved with Canada, with Haida, at least they've recognized Aboriginal title to Haida Gwaii. And over the private properties, they've agreed, they've got mechanisms for the Haida to have consented to those titles. Now, there's lots of like issues around that, and BC, you know, people have different views on that agreement. But, you know, the point I think is that there are lots of places in the country you can point to. You say, look, we've dealt with that issue. We've got processes in place to deal with this issue. We're negotiating, you know, different resolutions to these claims. So I think there's actually quite a bit in Canada that we can look to and sort of say, well, that's something we should be doing more of or less of, or, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakwin Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much, and we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
I have a couple more questions for you, Sam. One is, and I just wanted to go going back to the conversation 20 minutes ago, maybe, but I just want to be clear because we talked about kind of the practical implications for these folks that own property in Richmond in fee simple, and that there's an Aboriginal title, but there's no remedy, right? Now, of course, this may have implications for the value of their property, for financing, that those types of things. Can they actually sell the property? So without remedy, does this mean that John Smith can sell that property a week from now to Jane Doe and then she can, can it continue to trade hands at this point? Or practically can you sell that property?
So there's nothing in my read of the decision, and others might have different views, but there's nothing in my read of the decision that would affect people selling a property, right? Like, so the Aboriginal title, like it's upstream of the fee simple, like it's a burden on the Crown's title or whatever. So as between private landowners, like if you want to sell your property, you can sell it. Now, I'm not, again, within the claim area, that might be very difficult to do. And I think that's one of the practical consequences of that uncertainty. But there's nothing that should prevent it. And again, Cowichan has very clearly stated they're not interested in trying to pursue those lands and not trying to, you know, knock on someone's door and take their lands. In the case, there's nothing in the case that says that anything affects the fee simple lands. Like I say, the court has simply said, we have a declaration of Aboriginal title that doesn't displace the fee simple rights of third parties other than Richmond, Canada. And we're going to deal with that issue later, right? So we don't really know the answer to that question today, but there is nothing in the decision itself that would stop someone from selling their lands.
And what, you know, apart from, like, I'm just thinking of this declaration of Aboriginal title, the benefit to the Cowichan at this point, they're not going after the land. The land it's upstream, as you said, of the fee simple process, but I can sell my property and the person who buys it from me can trade it. What's the end game? And I know I'm not trying for you to speculate what the end game is, but in realistic or very specific terms, like what does this actually give the Cowichan if they don't have access to the property?
So at the end of the day, I mean, not unlike I think what you sort of see across the province is that there's a right. There's a right that the Cowichan have. And of course, like we're talking about fee simple rights are exclusive rights to property. Aboriginal right is an exclusive right to property. Both of these rights are not exercisable at the same time, right? Like it cannot both be true at the same time, but there is a right and it needs to be dealt with in some fashion. And so what the court has said is that the BC government as the provincial crown has an obligation to deal with that right in some fashion. Now the court isn't saying how they need to deal with it. The court isn't saying you have to go and exercise your expropriation powers and get those lands back and give them the Cowichan. Like, that's not what the court is saying. The court is saying you've got an obligation to negotiate in good faith to reconcile the fact that you've got these fee simple rights and an Aboriginal title right. And so that's sort of, you know, from, and I don't speak for Cowichan at all, but I think at the end of the day, it's some kind of resolution of what was a historic wrong, at least what the court found was a historic wrong. And that could include, like, you know, to be clear, it could include compensation. It could include other crown lands that might be available. There might be a variety of things that the crown could do to kind of address those issues. And I wouldn't want to sort of speculate on what a resolution looks like, but I can say that, you know, this is, you know, we have a BC treaty process, right? Almost every First Nation to some degree in some capacity has kind of been part of the BC treaty process. Now there's, you know, it's been a slow process for some and some aren't interested in pursuing it. But that's really at its core is trying to resolve this stuff. It's trying to say, like, there's an outstanding Aboriginal interest in this land. How do we resolve this through some kind of negotiated settlement? And so that's really ultimately, I think, where this goes.
And Sam, maybe, I mean, this might be a difficult question. And I wonder, maybe it's two questions, but what do you think the most likely outcome is from where we are now to kind of where this goes? And then the second question to that is like, is there a good outcome here or an outcome that you think would be kind of best case for kind of all parties?
Good is hard. It's hard to sort of like ascribe a sort of value to it. You know, I think ultimately I do think, and you know, we'll see, there is so much in this decision that needs to be unpacked. I think it'll be interesting to see. I think, like I say, appellate courts are going to be very concerned about what does this decision mean? What have we not dealt with? The fact that we've sort of declared Aboriginal title and there are these fee simple interests and we haven't resolved that, I think the courts are going to be concerned about that issue. And so, you know, if I was sort of crystal balling it, and this is just to be clear, like there are defenses, right? And so I think private landowners, where they sort of, if this were to not be resolved and things changed at Cowichan and ultimately decided down the road they're going to go and try and exercise their rights and get a, you know, some kind of judgment from the court to do that, there'll be defenses available for private landowners. But I think the court's going to be concerned about, you know, the idea that there is this sort of uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. I think they're going to be very concerned about that. So I would think that courts may find a way to kind of shelter third parties somehow through this litigation. There's a bunch of different ways that that could happen. So that's one comment. I think more broadly, you know, ultimately this is about trying to negotiate out and resolve issues. Like, you know, courts have consistently over and over again said, look, we'll provide guidance along the way. At the end of the day, they push it back to the Crown to sit down to try and sort out some of these issues. And they're not easy issues. It's easy to point your finger at the government and say, go solve it. But realistically, I think the best outcome is you know, I think BC's right to appeal it. I think all the parties, frankly, are going to appeal it. We need the guidance on what does the law say about this issue. It's a huge issue. And it's been out there for a while, to be clear. But I think actually having a decision and now having to grapple with it is something that we need the guidance from the court. We can't sort of have this like living cloud over all private property and potentially in the country. So I think we need that guidance. But I think in parallel to that, and as a broader sort of resolution, it's really about trying to sort these things out through negotiated settlements.
Yeah, and I should clarify just quickly what I meant by good. Like I'm actually thinking in a lot of the, you know, I mean, and this is probably just I should avoid reading the comment sections on articles and social media, et cetera, but I was thinking, like, could the Cowichan decision actually hurt reconciliation by deepening divisions instead of maybe building a better understanding of the reconciliation process? And that's maybe a challenging question, but
yeah, I mean, I would say, and again, personal view is like these are incredibly important societal issues. Like reconciliation is an incredibly important issue in Canada. But as is the interest of non-Indigenous peoples and private lands and in some of these sort of core values like private land ownership, right? So I do get concerned, right? Because there are important issues on both sides. But I do worry that these types of decisions are frankly, you know, where I think UNDRIP, for example, is widely sort of misunderstood, and I think people are concerned about it. I think the government has acknowledged perhaps they haven't communicated well enough on some of these issues. I think there's areas where the government maybe has gone too far. And I think you do risk, you know, losing public support on some of these issues. So, you know, I think we all have an interest in trying to, you know, continue to sort of take a step back and think, well, what's sort of the broader goal here? We're all here. We got to figure out ways to kind of work and live together in a way that benefits all of us, right? And so, you know, I think if we can kind of, you know, pull back to that, right, it makes a difference. But I don't think I would say more than that on that question.
But, well, it's interesting to think of because it's in one, thinking about one way, you don't want to move too fast or too dramatically. At the same time, the flip side to that is uncertainty, right? Going back to kind of a more practical question, you mentioned sheltering third parties in the fee simple, you know, fee simple owners in this process. I think Adams had people call him. I had a conversation yesterday morning where somebody literally said, watched a video online and called me and said, should I be selling my home? What, I guess, for everyday homeowners listening or, you know, mom and pop investors in residential real estate in Metro Vancouver, What is the best advice? Kind of like take a deep breath and keep living your life, and this will be worked out. What would be your advice there for people that are nervous?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, it's a little bit like giving notice to the landowners, you know, a number of years ago. Like, what practical purpose? Like, what would you do as a landowner? How would you have,
Is that a material late litigation?
Like, yeah. What are you going to do differently? So I think, you know, this is not a new issue. It's just that it's raised its head. We've opened a box in terms of like trying to understand, well, what is this issue? Now we've got a judgment on it. But the uncertainty existed before that. The interesting thing will be to see, you know, like I say, how do lenders respond to this, right? I think well-advised lenders will probably take a more sort of longer-term view of these things. But, you know, I wouldn't sort of say it's not an issue at all. Like, I get people call me in my role, and they're looking at investing or supporting or financing a project in Canada. They're like, well, what is this Cowichan decision about? But, you know, at the end of the day, I do feel like if you sort of look at the trajectory of the law and where Section 35 rights litigation has always gone, it's always the courts have generally pointed their finger back at the Crown, and they've said these are issues for the government to resolve. And I suspect that will continue to be the case. I would think that courts are going to be very reluctant to do things that would have remedies against sort of private third parties. Not to say that it could never, ever happen, but I think there's, you know, I think if you're someone living in the Lower Mainland, you go on with your life in the same way that you...
Sam, maybe as a final question, you know, you mentioned that you work in the resource sector. What's been the feedback you've gotten from, you know, big investors, not people looking to buy and sell single family homes, but people that are considering or involved in large scale projects here in the province? Does this impact them in any way?
So I'd say the short answer is probably no, in the sense that most resource developers, like if you're a major mining developer in the province of BC, you've been dealing with these issues for the last 20 or 30 years. Like you understand these issues. You know, I'd say the only place I get some questions about are maybe people that are unfamiliar with Canada, they're investing in, or maybe they're project financing something in Canada, and they sort of hear about the Cowichan decision and they want some information about it. But for the most part, like people that are in the business of developing natural resources understand the issues. And the reason for that is something that's kind of, we haven't talked about today, but most of what we talk about when we're talking about Aboriginal law and Section 35 in Canada is we're actually talking about something quite different, which is the duty to consult. And the duty to consult is something that came out of the case law. It came out of a case called HIDA, the Supreme Court of Canada. And we've sort of had it for about 20 or so years when that case came out. The duty to consult is actually dealing with the fact that these rights are mostly not known, right? So the fact that we have constitutional protection for rights, and that in theory, to prove a right, you have to go to court, like in the case of Cowichan, you had 500 plus days of court time. Like, it's impossible to ever sort of figure out what all the rights are through a litigation process like that. And so what the court did through the HIDA decision, they said, look, there are these rights, they are constitutionally protected. We don't necessarily know what they are, but the government, the Crown, you can't just ignore the rights because we know what they are. There's an obligation to consult and, where appropriate, accommodate those interests as part of decision-making processes. And in particular, that's the case on like large natural resource projects. So we have this idea of this duty to consult. And the net effect of the duty to consult is, for the last, I'd say 20 years, but longer really, is that if you're developing a mine in BC, you'll need thousands of permits. Probably you'll go through an environmental assessment, which is like a major permitting process. And through that process, the government has an obligation to consult Indigenous groups that might be affected by the decision, and to accommodate concerns as part of that process. And so what really happens in practice, and there's a bunch of reasons for doing this, but, you know, large natural resource developers will negotiate agreements with First Nations to get their consent or their support for a project. And that's what sort of allows, you know, these projects to proceed. So I'd say, you know, in specific response to your question, no, I don't think this has been a significant concern for a lot of natural resource developers because they've been dealing with this uncertainty for a long time. They understand it. They know how to operate within it. And there's some fairly, set practices for how people approach these things. And, I'd say with an Aboriginal title case like Cowichan arising, one of the biggest issues is that people are completely blindsided by it because they're not really aware of the law. They're not really aware of these broader issues, right? And that's just right. Not really the case in the natural resources sector. So
we do have this segment called the Five Wire, five lighthearted questions after a fairly heavy conversation here. Can you stick around for that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Jethro Condos in downtown Langley. Over 100 homes under $425,000 with one-bedroom suites starting at $399,900.
Here's what's incredible, Adam. These condos actually cash flow. When's the last time we could say that about new construction in the Lower Mainland? With these entry-level prices, the numbers actually work for investors.
And you're in the heart of downtown Langley, surrounded by trendy cafes, artisan bakeries, and parks. The area is experiencing incredible growth and new development.
Yeah, the location is absolutely key. Jethro is steps from the future Langley SkyTrain station. Get in before that transit connection transforms the area. Because once that SkyTrain arrives, you're looking at direct connections across the Lower Mainland.
Jethro is a Whitetail Homes project. Whitetail Homes has over 25 years of experience with quality construction and finishes that exceed expectations. We're talking vibrant interiors, expansive windows, and thoughtful design.
For realtors listening, they are offering amazing cooperative incentives. This is a rare opportunity where the fundamentals make sense. Affordable entry, cash flow potential, and positioned for major transit infrastructure in all around win.
Register at jethrocondos.ca. That's JETHRO condos.ca.
Jethro Condos, distinctly Langley, uniquely yours.
Okay, great. So first question is one book that you've read recently that you would recommend.
Oh, I mean, I like a lot of fiction. My wife just read Remarkably Bright Creatures, which is about an octopus in an aquarium in Washington. And I just picked that up and I'm enjoying it right now. I'd say, like, if you're interested in these issues, though, that I'm just talking about, a great book, particularly if you're from the prairies, like the three of us are, is The Company, which is the book about the Hudson's Bay Company.
Oh, and right.
It's kind of interesting because it actually, similar time frames as the Cowichan decision, right? It's just that interaction between the HBC and the fur traders and the push westward and the interaction with First Nations. So I'd recommend that as a pretty good read.
It's a fantastic recommendation. Sam, in last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? I have one in mind, but I'll let you come up with it.
Yours?
I'm just saying you picked up that. That was.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd say, my kids are, I have two daughters. They're 8 and 11. And they're just perfect, like the perfect age. And I think if anything I could sort of say that I've tried to sort of do is just to like slow down and just enjoy, it's chaos, right? Like you guys have kids. It's chaos. Every day is chaotic. And I try to manage work and life and school and all this stuff. But if you can just kind of slow down and just appreciate like those little moments, your kids wanting a quick cuddle at bed or reading a book to them or whatever it is, like those things, I admit, I'm not perfect at all, but I think that's something I've really tried to focus in on the last couple of years. So
that's a great one. Sam, what have you been binge watching lately or a movie recommendation?
Black Rabbit. I'm watching that, which is pretty good.
Nice.
And then we've been watching Nobody Wants This is the other one I'm watching right now. So we kind of go between Black Rabbit, which I love, but it's very dark. And then we turn over to something a bit more happy, which is Nobody Wants This, which is more of a romantic kind of comedy type thing. So
nice.
Sam, what music are you into? I was trying to frame this in a way thinking of you and Adam jamming in the past. But what music are you binging these days or listening to?
I got two girls, so it's all Taylor Swift all the time.
Oh yeah. I can relate. It could be worse. It could be worse than Taylor Swift, though. I'm kind of. Last but not least, Sam, something you've purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life.
That's a good question. I don't know. I've lived in Vancouver for like 20 years, And as you guys know, I'm a Winnipegger originally. And I kind of resisted the outdoor wear and the Lululemons and all that stuff. But I recently bought the Lululemon pants. And they're a big part of my life right now. So that's what I'm giving you.
That's I can relate. I was late to be converted, but once you go, you know, Sam, I guarantee 5 years from now you'll be decked out all Lululemon. It's the way it goes. Well, Sam, thanks so much for taking the time today. Really appreciate your insight. And I, for one, have a much better understanding of what's happening here with the couch and decision. I think our listeners are going to have a lot of good takeaways as well.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Sam. So there you have it, folks. Our discussion with Vancouver lawyer, Sam Adkins.
Geez, first time on the show, but man, I hope we can get Sam back for updates on this. Always great talking to him. We know him personally, and just a great guy all around. So yeah, really glad that he took the time today. For sure.
So good. I don't know what the hourly rate would have been there, Adam, but I know we can't afford it. So yeah, we're very grateful for.
I had to block sender. I'm worried he's going to send an invoice. Dodging Sam's calls for a while. Matt, what else do we got before we cut for the day?
What else do we have? Well, we got VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is, of course, where all real estate related things live. We have Private Client Services. That's our buyer's resource. We have the Sold Plan. That's our seller's resource. But more importantly, Adam, we're trying to get the show back on track here. I don't think we ever lost the track, but we're trying to grow. We're growing through this market. So if you enjoyed our conversation with Sam or any of our recent episodes, please share with a friend or review, and that helps us grow. And yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, and I'd like to remind people, I just met with someone recently who I did a market analysis for their place. And when I talked to her initially, she said, oh, I didn't know that you guys sold real estate. So yes, we are realtors who have a podcast, not podcasters who occasionally sell real estate. So this is what we do. So if you are thinking of listing this fall or in the upcoming new year, please do reach out. We're happy to do an analysis on your place. And if you found this podcast or any podcast we've done over the past decade useful, I think there's almost 500 episodes to choose from. Please feel free to send it to a friend. And of course, feel free to leave a comment either on Spotify, which it seems to be there's more comments there these days, or Google or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. And Matt, how can people get in touch?
Yeah, you can comment to me directly, 778-847-2854 or matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that nonpartisan line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And I am honestly, we're going out, the balance of the year here, Q4 is going to be so strong. We've got so many great guests coming up, including a wealth manager, financial advisor, who's going to discuss all things portfolio and how it ties into real estate holdings. We've got tax specialists coming up. We've got a professor from UBC. We're super excited to welcome back onto the show. So many great guests coming. I can't wait. And it's going to be a strong finish to 2025.
Hit that subscribe button. We'll talk to you soon.
2000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.